Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm looking at a bit of an older Eric Hoven video from back when he had a TV show with Paul Taylor. Not to be confused with the comedian Paul Taylor. In this one, he is interviewing Jay Siegert of the Creation Education Center. And since it's in a TV show format where they have to fill up their time to a half an hour, they do a bunch of unrelated rambling and product promotion. So I'm going to try and just skip the irrelevant bits. Let's take a look.
And that's when my world changed quite a bit, going from a small Christian college where my engineering professors opened up in prayer to a very large state university where my physics professors did not open up in prayer. And they were all evolutionists, some were atheists, and they were telling me in essence that everything I believe was wrong.
Well, I wouldn't say that everything you believe is wrong, but as a young Earth creationist, there certainly is quite a bit that you must believe that is demonstrably wrong. So they might have overgeneralized, but they're not too far from the mark.
And that made me very uncomfortable to be surrounded by these PhD scientists who I assumed had a lot of evidence for what they believed.
As it should. There's a reason that in the scientific community, young Earth creationists are in the very extreme minority, despite the fact that they make up about 38% of the general population of the US, with that number being the lowest that it has hit since the 1980s. And what's more, if we look at the breakdown of who believes in young Earth creationism by education and religion, the more educated you are, the less likely you are to be a young Earth creationist. And the more religious you are, the more likely you are to be a young Earth creationist. Almost like when you get yourself an education and put aside your presupposition that the Bible has to be right about everything it says, it becomes obvious that evolution is how life develops, and the Earth is older than 6 to 10,000 years.
Can we just jump right into some of the stuff we were talking about before the show?
Can we just jump right in, he says at the 5 minute and 45 second mark, after spending almost the entire time talking about the various conferences, books, DVDs, websites, etc. Dude, just promote the guy's website where you should be able to find everything and move on.
Sure, it's very important to talk about defining because sometimes you get into a conversation with someone and you can be talking about something completely different and it causes a lot of problems. So if we take a look at what I'm not referring to by evolution, it's not simply change. A lot of people think, well, change is evolution. So if we as Christians say, well, we don't believe in evolution, you're thinking we're crazy. We don't believe in change.
It would have to be someone who doesn't spend any significant amount of their time studying anything about evolution to come up with just the word change as the definition of evolution.
Well, we see change all the time. So evolution certainly involves change, but it's not just any kind of change. It's a very specific type of change.
Yes, it is a very specific type of change. It is the change in allele frequencies in a population over successive generations. That is the most basic definition of evolution that should be the simplest to explain to a layperson.
And we see change all the time. I mean, we see different dogs and cats and horses, and we do see different beaks on finches that Darwin got very excited about.
Right. Yes, and that is evolution. Sure, it's typically classified as microevolution, at least with the cats, dogs, and horses that you showed, but the finches didn't just change their beaks. There were changes in coloration, size, mating habits, food sources, and some other characteristics, such that there are several distinct species of finch living on the Galapagos in an obvious real-world example of relatively fast macroevolution. But also, microevolution and macroevolution both use the same basic mechanisms for the most part. Mutation, migration, genetic drift, and natural selection. Creationists like to draw a line between these two, but the line is entirely arbitrary, and they always have to keep shifting it to accommodate examples that obviously cross the line.
These are actually facts of science, and we see them all the time. Creationists don't deny change. So this is not what we're talking about. What we are talking about are these kind of changes, that supposedly there was a single-celled organism that existed maybe 3.8 billion years ago that slowly evolved in every other life form on this planet.
Yeah, you can deny that if you want, but that is where the evidence points, like it or not. And we can arrive at this conclusion from several independent lines of evidence, any of which could have falsified the entire thing. Genetics didn't have to come along and confirm what we had learned from paleontology, but it did.
Sometimes we call it molecules to man evolution.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes you do. But as cute as that sounds, it betrays some basic misunderstandings of science. Because you are, quite literally, made of molecules. When you eat, you are not eating people. Hopefully, anyway. But whatever you are eating, the process of digestion is entirely focused around taking the molecules from your food and putting them in your body. So every time you eat, you are engaged in a molecules-to-man process. Well, for men anyways. So that actually is a pretty good representation of how creationists typically handle science. They selectively present what sounds best while ignoring the vast body of facts that directly contradict what they are saying.
You see different even species. Occasionally we can even see a new species and say, well, that's a demonstration of evolution right there.
Literally, the definition of macroevolution is evolution that transcends the species level. In other words, the development of a new species. If you are willing to admit that a new species can evolve, even if only sometimes, then you are by definition admitting that macroevolution is possible.
But again, creationists aren't against change. They're not even against the idea of occasionally a new species coming up.
Creationists are not against macroevolution. You heard it here first.
But we don't see those new species or varieties due to a gain of genetic information. It's just a shuffling of existing information, or most of the time actually destroying a lot of that information.
And again, we come to the question that I have never heard a creationist actually address. What do you mean by information? How do you quantify it? Are you just measuring the overall amount of genetic material? Is there something less tangible that you're appealing to? Because we've seen gene duplications, horizontal gene transfer, whole genome duplications, insertions, and a few more mechanisms that all add genetic material into the genome. Are you somehow quantifying the amount of information by morphology rather than genetics? Because we've seen new structures and functions develop, such as the new protein that gives the carriers of the ApoA1 melano mutation their resistance to heart disease. It is a new protein. That is, it formed as a result of a single nucleotide polymorphism, which is where one single base pair is swapped for one other base pair. So the same overall amount of genetic material, just one little base pair changed, and you get a new protein. Is that more information, less information, or the same amount?
Do you think that there's sometimes a deliberate disingenuousness about the way that that evolutionists will phrase this when they say, here's one change happening here, so therefore that proves that change happens across different species and so on?
When all else fails, attack the motivations of your opponent. Good job, Paul.
Sure, I think sometimes that can happen. I think the majority of evolutionists are pretty sincere. They've really only been presented one side of the story, so they grow up believing in that, and some of them become teachers and professors, so they just continue on the same story.
I'm sure there are plenty of people out there who grew up being properly educated about evolution, but that is by no means a universal experience.
And they're not necessarily trying to lie to anyone. It kind of makes sense to them, but they really haven't heard the other side and don't know a lot of the details behind it.
I very much doubt that most scientists in the United States just haven't heard about creationism and aren't at least familiar enough with it to be able to debunk the creationist claims that have to do with their area of expertise. And it's not like non-creationist was the default for all scientists and always has been that way up until a brave group of boat rockers came along and started questioning those evolutionary ideas. As creationists are so fond of pointing out, most scientists over the last 1500 years or so were of the opinion that the Earth was just a few thousand years old. The scientists who ended up concluding that the Earth and universe are older than that were the ones who, rather than looking at the question from a perspective of having to make it fit with the Bible, allowed themselves the freedom to interpret the data without first running it through a religious test.
So if somebody said, the only reason you're a creationist right now is because that's the way you were raised, would you say no? I mean, I've looked at both sides. Respond to that real quick before we take a break.
Sure. I think when I was young, that would be the case. I grew up believing in Christ, believing in the Bible, and believing in creation because that's what I've been taught was the only thing that I was taught. But as I got older, I had to look into these things myself, and it just kind of confirmed that what I believed was correct. So I did go through some of the struggles and looking at some of the evidences and arguments for and against it, and I am a stronger Christian now for it.
I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I know everything that he went through in order to arrive at the conclusions that he has today, but just keep in mind that he literally did just say that he was raised in it and that's why he believed it when he was younger. And then pair that with the fact that the book that they insist always has to be correct in everything it says literally says to indoctrinate your children to prevent them from leaving the faith when they're older. So rather than analyzing his statement and trying to figure out whether he believes because of his indoctrination or because of an unbiased examination of the evidence, I would instead ask, why are these guys going to such great lengths to insist that their belief in young Earth creationism is not the result of being raised in the way the Bible says to raise a kid? Is biblical parenting not good enough for them? Is there something wrong with this method of raising kids that they recognize and so go out of their way to point out that they aren't the result of that particular instruction?
Why is it that evolution has so convinced these people? What is it that they're seeing?
Sure. Again, usually they've only seen one side, and what we call elephant hurling goes on, where these huge statements are thrown out there that there's tons of evidence from every area of science that proves evolution. And they've typically only been shown evolution, the idea, from a certain angle. And from a certain vantage point, it can seem kind of plausible.
Quite the contrary, over the course of my channel, I've had to look at evolution from all sorts of different angles and vantage points. And without fail, the creationist arguments rely entirely on presenting a partial picture of the evidence in an attempt to control the narrative, while the evidence, when viewed in its entirety, actually does point straight to evolution.
Right. And one example would be if we take a look at a transition supposedly from a lungfish into a newt.
Well, the morphological similarity between the lungfish and the newt is quite superficially striking. The consensus now is that tetrapods, including amphibians like the newt, but also, you know, all the other tetrapods, are descended from lobe-finned fish from the Pandorichthyidae order rather than lungfish. Fun fact, having four limbs likely evolved before the move out of water. Limb-like appendages would have been helpful in shallow water with dense vegetation for stalking prey. And since the lung evolved well before limbs did, these limb-bearing fish descendants already had a mechanism for surviving, at least briefly, out of water. And as has been shown with experiments on what I have affectionately dubbed the monster dinosaur puppyfish, some of the other adaptations to becoming a terrestrial organism can happen quite rapidly thanks to the phenomenon known as phenotypic plasticity, which is when an organism's morphology, behavior, or physiology can change in response to the environment that the organism finds itself in.
These creatures look kind of similar to begin with, and you could envision, doesn't take too much imagination to envision the fins getting a little bit stronger, and maybe it could learn how to crawl, and then it peeks its head out of the water and can somehow learn how to breathe air.
Well, the air breathing came first. Because of the viscosity and density of water when compared with air, the oxygen content of a volume of water will usually be about 3% that of the oxygen content of a similar volume of air, and it takes a good deal more metabolic energy to extract oxygen from water than it does from air. So there has been a selection pressure on water-dwelling organisms to develop a way to take advantage of the easier source of oxygen since the beginning. But as oxygen concentrations increased through the Devonian, this selection pressure also increased. So when these already at least partially air-breathing fish started living in shallow environments that increased the selection pressures that would lead to the development of the traits that led to the emergence of the tetrapods, it wouldn't have taken much at all to adapt these primitive tetrapods to a semi-aquatic environment.
It eventually crawls up onto land and it turns into something more like a newt or reptile. So,
see, now that betrays the classic misunderstanding of evolution that creationists always seem to have. An organism doesn't move into a new environment as is, and then take millions of years of not being able to survive in that environment before developing the features that would then allow them to survive there. It's that there are always going to be features of an organism, whether they be morphological, behavioral, or physiological, that can have multiple potential uses, even if the organism only uses them for one thing at the moment. The lung is actually a great example of this. To the best of our knowledge, lungs have evolved twice. In one lineage, they went on to become the lungs that we know in the terrestrial tetrapods today. In the other lineage, they developed into a swim bladder, an organ that helps a fish maintain buoyancy. And modern lungs can still be used to alter buoyancy today. You can test this yourself. Next time you go swimming, try sitting on the bottom of the pool with your lungs filled with air. Then again after exhaling as much air as possible. Then compare how easy it is to stay on the bottom in each scenario. Evolution doesn't build completely new things out of nowhere in response to a sudden change in the environment. Evolution alters things that were there already to make them better at performing sometimes very different functions than they were originally developed for. And yes, sometimes the environment does change rapidly, and that can lead to rapid changes in these features that were already there, but it's still not just popping a new feature out of nothing, it's working with what it already has. So, basic lungs came first, and then as organisms started spending more time out of water, the ones whose lungs worked better for that purpose had more success, and so natural selection favored those ones. Wash, rinse, repeat.
we can kind of picture that happening, especially when they tell us, oh, there are millions and billions of years that have gone on. So it might seem plausible on the surface.
No, you see, we don't pick these superficially similar organisms and then say that they're related in order to make it seem superficially plausible. We watch you pick these organisms in order to make that point, and then we point out that the origin of the lung goes back farther than that, and in fact, newts and humans have the same common ancestor for the lung.
But when you peek under the hood, that's where you start to see problems, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But there's a lot of storytelling that goes on with evolution. For example, we have four pictures of transportation here, and we could rearrange these things so that they're in order from simple to complex. We could talk about the evolution of the motorcycle. It goes from the two small wheels in the back of a tricycle on up to two major wheels and into electric motor of a scooter.
I feel like I always have to point out to creationists that evolution can't happen without reproduction. If something doesn't reproduce, it won't evolve. Remember the definition I gave, that evolution is a change in allele frequencies over successive generations? If you take out the successive generations part of that, it doesn't work anymore.
And then doing a gas engine of a motorcycle, and we see that seems kind of ridiculous because we know of the complexity that has to go on in there.
No, it's not the complexity that gives it away, it's the lack of reproductive capability.
Well, we could look, too, at how evolution supposedly works. We've got stories like this, where you've got evolution in action, and this is typically how it would be presented in a classroom setting. You've got an organism that's going to reproduce itself, and so it copies its DNA and passes it on to its children.
Okay, so you do know that reproduction is a key part of the process. So can I expect to never see evolution compared to things that don't actually reproduce again? Or is this just a selective blind spot?
And the children come out looking pretty much like parents, and then the children have children. Those are the grandchildren. They look pretty much the same as their parents and the grandparents. And then the grandchildren have children that copy the DNA, but oops, once in a while, we've got mutations going on. These are these accidental random changes in the genes, and they tell us that some of these changes are bad. And they said, admit, yeah, most of them are bad, but once in a while, there are some good ones too.
Couple things here. Firstly, the first generation children are mostly similar to the parents, that is true, but it yada yadas over the fact that there is normal variation that is not caused by genetic mutation. There are many different factors that can produce variation among offspring, but the fact that a child is not absolutely identical to its parents is a very important factor in evolution. Second, most mutations are completely neutral. They don't change anything. Of the non-neutral mutations, more are harmful than beneficial, and that's where natural selection kicks in. The harmful ones don't propagate through the community because they are harmful. And it's important to note here that harmful and beneficial are relative terms. A harmful mutation for an organism in one environment can be a beneficial one in another environment. When speaking in evolutionary terms, harm and benefit are measured by their impact on reproductive success, not on whether or not that mutation makes the life better for the individual who has it. After all, matrophagy is a thing. There are species, mostly arachnids but also a few others, whose offspring will eat their mother as soon as they hatch. The mother dies, it's not good for her, but her offspring have a much better chance at survival than in similar species who do not engage in matrophagy. I don't think anyone would argue that from an individual perspective, the mutations that led to this behavior are beneficial to the mothers. But evolutionarily speaking, it is quite beneficial.
And then you've got natural selection coming along that said to get rid of the bad ones and keep the good ones. And then the replication continues on where you've got the new good ones reproducing themselves and the original ones. So you can imagine this going on for millions and millions of years. Eventually, you'd have a great, great variety.
Yes, that last part was actually decently summarized. Now, let's see how long before he goes off the rails again.
Sure. Well, the problem has to do with these mutations that are going on. We'll eventually get into some of that. But let's take a closer look at these mutations. And in order to do that, we'll probably first take a look at what's going on with DNA itself, which is really interesting. If you had even a teaspoon amount of your own DNA and wanted to back up that much data, let's say onto CDs. CDs can store a lot of information.
Right.
So if we wanted to back up that much information onto CDs, how many CDs would we need? Well, sometimes I say we would need 100 CDs just for a teaspoon amount of our own DNA.
How is that in any way relevant to anything we're talking about? Fun to mention, though, as time goes on, this example becomes much less impressive. A CD can hold about 700 megabytes of data, so assuming their DNA math was right, 100 CDs is about 70 gigabytes of data. So if we want to use DVDs, we only have 15 DVDs. But then we decide to go to Blu-ray, and now we're down to just two dual-layer Blu-ray discs. But why are we using optical media? That stuff is mostly obsolete at this point. Let's go to solid-state storage, where this SSD that is roughly the size of a guitar pick can store more than three times that amount. But I guess it would take 100 CDs to store the same amount of information as 1 teaspoon of DNA sounds more impressive than the amount of information 1 teaspoon of DNA can be stored on this guitar pick-sized hard drive three times over. And of course, it's worth mentioning that this wouldn't actually be 70 gigabytes of data. There's no reason to store the genome multiple times over. It's just a bunch of copies of the same data. So really, this would all break down into how much space you would need to store your genome once, which, if I did my math right and assume that the genome is being stored in 8-bit characters, with each character being 1 byte, that's 3 billion bytes for our 3 billion letter genome for a total of about 3,000 megabytes, which can comfortably fit on just 5 CDs, less than 1 DVD or Blu-ray, and also less than one of any solid-state storage device whose capacities were definitely up past 3 gigabytes in 2016 when this video was uploaded. Hell, just for good measure, it would be 2,084 1.44 megabyte floppy disks. Wow, that was a lot of work to say absolutely nothing. Why do creationists think this is important?
It's a lot of information.
And it would be nice if that was right, but it isn't. That's actually a lie. We'd actually need 1,000 CDs to back up just a teaspoon, and even that's a lie. We'd actually need 1 million CDs to back up the amount of information in just a teaspoon amount of our own DNA.
Dude!
No, we wouldn't. Because of the aforementioned redundancy in our genome being repeated there multiple times. A greater amount of genetic material does not mean more data, it just means more copies of the same data. But tangential to this, does that mean that what you mean when you say that information always decreases is just a straight-up measurement of genetic material based entirely on quantity? Because that doesn't work for creationism because of the aforementioned insertion and duplication mutations. If you can just lump a teaspoon of DNA together and marvel at how much information is there, then I can point to these mutations and say, see, it increased the amount of information there. So either stop with the CDs, or admit that new information can and is introduced to genomes by mutations.
Whoa! We are complex.
Yes, needlessly so. Not every cell in our body needs the entire genome in order to function. It only needs the very specific parts of the genome that it uses. But our bodies waste a lot of resources duplicating the entire genome out into every cell of the body, except for a few like the haploid cells. The hallmark of good design is simplicity, not complexity. When things are complex that could be simple, it creates problems. The simpler a system, the easier it is to maintain, the longer it can run on its own without breaking down. The human body is needlessly complex and is subject to regular breakdowns.
We talk about mutations, even evolutionists again admit that the vast majority of mutations are deleterious or bad, but they say once in a while we've got some good ones, and there's a lot of problems with that concept. Even we've shown today that most of the mutations are actually have such a small detrimental effect that natural selection doesn't even really see them,
Wow. So
they don't get weeded out.
What he's talking about here is the difference between the neutral mutation model and the near-neutral mutation models for evolution. Both play an important role in our understanding of evolution, and the neutral mutation model is the one that gave us the first hints that selection isn't the only mechanism involved in evolution, with genetic drift playing a much larger role than was previously thought. It's also important to note that these two models are not necessarily in conflict with each other. Both can operate in a population simultaneously, as there are different categories of mutations that are either slightly deleterious or beneficial, and these categories are different from the ones that are truly neutral. Now, the way creationists present this, they would have you believe that these slightly deleterious mutations are gradually accumulating throughout the generations and will lead to the eventual extinction of the species, such as when he says this.
In fact, one evolutionist said, it's amazing that we're not dead 100 times over because of the apparent accumulation of all these small mutations over millions and millions of years.
But that's just not the case. I'm not sure which evolutionist he's referring to here, or when they said it, or what the context was, but I can tell you that the near-neutral model, while it isn't perfect and does have some problems accounting for what we see in the data, will only lead to an increase in these negative mutations when the population size is restricted. In large populations, genetic drift effectively eliminates them through non-selection methods. And that gets us back to the crux of the matter. When the neutral mutation model was originally proposed in the 1950s, it was in competition with selection as the mechanism by which species change, the idea being that genetic drift was playing a stronger role than the selection methods. As time went on, we learned that, as is often the case with such things, it's actually a combination of both, and the near-neutral mutation model was added in to account for more data that wasn't quite covered by either of the two. Now, of course, I am greatly oversimplifying this, but they promised me a more in-depth discussion on how information works in their final segment, so let's skip ahead to that.
And just one example, if we were to take a look at DNA, let's say we're looking at a certain segment of DNA, and we were reading that segment, and we would read a little stretch of it, and it said, "Was it a rat I saw?"
Okay, starting right off the bat with a terrible analogy. Let's see where this goes.
Kind of a strange statement, but let's clean it up here a little bit and look at it. We in English read from left to right. So, "Was it a rat I saw?" What's interesting about this little sentence is you can read it backwards from right to left.
Some sentences are palindromes. Some DNA sequences are also palindromes. That's nice. Hurry it up. What's your point?
So that's what we're seeing in the DNA. It's called reverse transcription, except it's more complex in our DNA.
That is not where I expected this to go, but I don't see how that is analogous to reverse transcription. Transcription is when DNA unzips and gets copied into mRNA, which then gets translated into a protein. Reverse transcription can only happen when specific enzymes are present, like reverse transcriptase. It will copy an RNA sequence into a complementary DNA sequence that then gets inserted into the genome of a cell. This is how retroviruses work, and this is also how CRISPR-Cas9 works, roughly speaking. It is not the same as just reading a sentence forward and backward and finding that it is a palindrome.
This is the same information forwards and backwards. Let's take a look at this word here, desserts. We read that from left to right again. If we were to reverse this and go from right to left, it spells the word stressed. So this one can be read forwards and backwards, but when we read it backwards, it's a separate piece of information.
So is that more information, less information, or the same amount of information? I don't know why you're talking about reverse transcription, but you're doing a pretty decent job of explaining why the creationist oversimplification of the topic information is completely inadequate.
So now let's take a look at some mutations.
Well, just a moment, because when you read something forwards and when you're reading it backwards, what you're saying is that that is the way that DNA is read inside us, that the reading mechanism inside us might see different messages in different directions across the same section of molecule.
Right, same section of molecule. You can read it one way, it's one set of instructions. We read it reverse the other way, and it's a separate set of instructions.
Okay, that's it. I'm done. Fuck that. I think these guys just killed off anyone with a background in basic biology with this mangled explanation of how DNA works. I think we've learned that these guys don't even have the most basic grasp of this subject matter, and so are completely unable to speak on the subject, much less prove it wrong. Congrats, guys. You found my breaking point where I just can't take the misinformation anymore and have to check out. Well done.
Wife!
What?
You need to go buy some beer!
What?
Creationists!
That's it for this one. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Pablo Sanchez, who says, "It's 100 arguments for God in binary." This was on my response to Capturing Christianity's 100 Arguments for God livestream, in which I noted that most of the arguments are basically the same, but with ever so slight variations. Well done, Pablo. Well done. And for those of you who don't get it, 100 in binary is 4. Thanks for watching. Special thanks as always to my patrons, Lynn Dobbs, Mark McManus, What Jesus, and all the rest, who are the beer money that keeps the fridge that is my channel stocked. If you'd like to delay my inevitable descent into madness, or speed it up, I'm not entirely sure which, you can join us on Patreon for as little as $1 per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino. If you feel so inclined, you can also support the channel through direct donation or my Amazon wishlist, which are linked in the description. If you'd like to listen to my videos in podcast form, the link for that is also in the description, as well as links to my social media accounts and my PO Box address. See you next time!